see how it goes. I gotta find the right set of notes. I've got so many papers here in front of me. I was involved in a session earlier today, and so this is the second session that I've chaired and trying to make sure everything goes okay. And this is session 14, Persistence of Polygamy. Book review session, or book preview session, actually a forthcoming preview of a book that I happen to be the co-editor of, along with Craig Foster. And my name is Newell Bringhurst, and I see a lot of familiar faces that were here earlier, so a lot of you already know, and I think I know most of people. So that's one nice thing about a small intimate conference like this. It seems like you get to know the whole of the people that are involved, and there seems to be more interaction. It seems more informal, and that's one of the things I've always liked about Sunstone West Symposium, sort of similar to John Whitmer, of which I'm a very active involved member of that organization. And in fact, the book that we're going to be previewing today is forthcoming from John Whitmer Books. And I'm going to pass out a, could I get you to help me a little bit with this, Mike? Make sure that everybody gets one of these. This will kind of follow the format a little bit of my presentation, which will be an introduction to the two other people that are going to be involved today. And I'm just going to say a little bit about the two other participants who are going to be presenting. They're two of the 20-some-odd authors who will be contributing to the Persistence of Polygamy volume. And these are both individuals that one's a younger scholar and one's a more established scholar. And the more established scholar is hardly needs any introduction to a Sunstone audience. He's kind of a mainstay, kind of a stalwart of Sunstone. I think he's been involved with Sunstone almost from its beginnings, at least with Sunstone West. I haven't you, Todd? I think you've been going back to the 80s, quite probably late 80s. Yeah. So Todd is almost a charter member of Sunstone, and the author of one of the most important books dealing with Mormon polygamy, In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, really a seminal study that I highly, highly recommend. I guess it goes back to the time I was asked to write a blurb for the back of it when it came out back in 1997. He's also the editor of A Widow's Tale, which deals with another polygamist relationship that involved Helen Mar Kimball. He edited the diary of this plural wife. And he's also the co-editor of Fire and Sword, or co-author, I'm sorry, of Fire and Sword, A History of Latter-day Saints in Northern Missouri, 1835 to 39. And that is forthcoming. And who is publishing that, Todd?
Greg
Coford Books is publishing that and coming out in 2010. And the book that I'm really looking forward to, that I'm eagerly anticipating, is a biography of Jacob Hamblin that he's currently working on. Now, Don Bradley, he's our younger scholar, and he's somebody that I've really gotten to know and appreciate over the last, I think we first met, I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago when Richard Bushman, I think we met at the Salt Lake Library when Richard Bushman spoke. Yeah. And that was, that's been quite a while ago. That's been several years ago. And I meeting him at that time, I saw in this guy, a promise of a significant future scholar there. He was a student at the University of Utah. I think you were, or maybe you'd finished up at the U, I can't remember. But he's now a graduate student working under Phil Barlow in the Religious Studies program up at Utah State University. And he's also presented on numerous occasions at Sunstone Symposia and at Mormon History Association meetings. He's a well-traveled scholar, even though he's as young as he is, and he's going to be doing two essays in the volume, which I will mention, as will Todd. I mean, between the two of them, they're doing four of the 25 essays that are going to appear in the volume itself, and I'm not sure which ones they want to discuss. I know Todd mentioned he was going to focus on the bibliography essay at the end, but let me just go ahead and give a little bit of background about what the volume entails. You've got that, and it'll kind of follow what's on the back there of that handout that I just passed out. As you can see, it'll consist of 25 original. I think this is what's unique about this. It's not a reprint volume. These are all original, never before published essays that Craig Foster and I have managed to compile over a 2-year period. Dealing with this, I have to confess that if you want to undertake editing a work with a bunch of authors, it's a bit like herding cats. It requires persistence and patience with a bit of humor. It's sort of like teaching. You know, it's like being an educator. But anyway, as I say, our volume differs not only because they're all original essays, but also because it considers kind of the holistic aspects of polygamy, the complexities and variations in the practice as it spanned 3 centuries from its beginnings in the early 1830s, the beginning of the LDS movement, all the way, and as it evolved and was ultimately rejected by the Utah Church. It is also unique in that it considers the differing reactions to polygamy by various schismatic Mormon groups. Nobody's really done that adequately. You know, some of these groups that, like the Strangites, the Cutlerites, and its rejection by people like Sidney Rigdon and Stephen Post. And so we're looking at it within that context, and that's something that's a little bit different. And we're also considering plural marriage as practiced by the Mormon fundamentalists. And the scholarship is also unique in that we try to select a variety of scholars, ranging from established experts like Todd Compton, who have previously written extensively on the topic, to younger scholars like Don over there, who is in the position of bringing forth fresh insights, including the most recent and latest methodologies. Now, the total length of the volume will be some 400 to 450 pages. And our book is designed to appeal not just to scholars, but also to and laypersons interested in Mormon history per se, but also designed for people in the larger fields of religious studies and gender studies. And the anticipated publication date of the volume is September of 2010 by John Whitmer Books. And that thing that I pass out you is also could serve as a pre-order form. So if you want to reserve a copy of the book, and I can't quote a price yet, my editor and the people publishing it are still working on what, you know, we still haven't quite got the exact length and configuration all the way down there. I'll be honest with you, there's still 3 essays that we haven't received yet that are still outstanding, including the 2 by Don. He's going to give them to me very shortly, and I give him an added prod here. But he's well at
the end of the lecture.
Yeah, he's assiduously at work on them as we speak, you know, as I speak. But anyway, just briefly, an overview of the volume. It doesn't mention that on the opening chapter is an introduction. They didn't put that on the when they made up that flyer. But there is an introduction, which is actually a historical overview of Mormon polygamy from Joseph Smith to the fundamentalists. You might add that, you know, that makes it going to make it even longer. But that's actually that's something that Craig Foster and I will be writing. We haven't written that yet because we haven't got all the essays in hand, and we want to try to figure out how we're going to make sense out of all of this. And the volume itself is divided into 3 sections, as you can see from that outline that I've given you. The first section focuses on Joseph Smith and the beginnings of Mormon polygamy to 1844. And it contains 7 essays, including the first one is written by Don Bradley. And it's a very interesting and provocative essay, because what it deals with is the question, and I got the title of it, Polygamy before Nauvoo, and it should be question mark. It should be, Polygamy before Nauvoo, question mark. The cases of Fanny Alger and Lucinda Harris, were they or were they not plural wives of Joseph Smith prior to when it was really became much more, when the practice of polygamy as promoted by Joseph Smith didn't really become widespread until around 1841, and Don will be addressing that in his essay. The second essay is one, there is actually a group of 2 essays that follow, dealing with the all-important and critical section of the Doctrine and Covenants 132. Because one of the things that became really apparent to myself, as well as Craig Foster, is the paucity of work that has been done in really seriously examining and analyzing section 132. Of the Doctrine and Covenants, which in many ways is the linchpin, the theological linchpin for Mormon polygamy. And Craig and I look at it quite differently. Craig, in his essay, we were originally going to do it as a single essay, but we found that we couldn't quite come to a consensus on what was important about 132. I saw it in a little bit different respect than Craig did, which is kind of understandable considering where we're both coming from, where he's a very devout, believing, practicing Latter-day Saint, and I'm not quite in that same category. And so we kind of came to different perceptions of what was important and not important about 132, and so it kind of morphed into two essays. His, where he sees the emphasis on the importance of family, Joseph Smith's expanding concept of family, and I saw it in a somewhat broader, different sense. And then we have an essay, a provocative essay done by Brian C. Hales on Joseph Smith and the puzzlement of polyandry. Yeah, if you were in the lecture this morning, you know, what is polyandry involve? It involves a woman having more than one husband, and how that was handled within the context of Mormon polygamy. That's what Brian Hales is focusing on. And then Todd Compton has got, then they come to a series of two essays that kind of deal with the same topic, another very controversial topic, the topic of teen marriages in Nauvoo as they took place within early Mormon polygamy. And those of you who attended last year's Sunstone up in Cupertino, you know, Todd gave a preliminary presentation on that, which serves as the basis for his contribution of the essay in this volume here. And then Craig Foster and a group of 2 other scholars, Craig and Greg Smith and David Keller, again look at it somewhat different. I mean, you get an idea here. We've tried to allow for differences of opinion and controversy in this volume. It's that's been one of the interesting things about putting this together. And then the last essay in this first section is going to be done by Hugo Perego. And it deals with the question of Smith, the issue of Smith's polygamous offspring. Did he or did he not have polygamous children by utilizing DNA analysis? And that's going to be the last essay, as I say, in the section. The second section deals with the whole issue of polygamy following Joseph Smith's death, as it evolved within Utah Mormonism, within the various schismatic movements that emerged, and the reaction of the RLDS Church, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The first essay is one that hasn't been written yet, that is one of the outstanding ones, and I must plead guilty on this part. It's going to be one, is going to be entitled, What Happened to All of Brigham Young's Wives?, which is actually a historiographical inquiry involving changing Mormon perceptions. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, there was a manual for gospel doctrine classes. It was a thing on Brigham Young. And nowhere did it mention his plural wives. There was kind of a little bit of a dust up over that. And it stood in stark contrast to the reality of Brigham Young's situation, which I wrote about in a little biography that I wrote back in the 1986, in which I managed to come up with 55 women. You know, Brigham Young had 55 wives that he was married to, and by whom he had 57 children, but nowhere in that gospel doctrine pamphlet or thing that was used. And so, the problem of, what happened to change the changing perceptions relative to polygamy? And then the next essay is a very fascinating one by a path-breaking essay by Connell O'Donovan. And it's entitled Plural Marriage and African Americans, Race, Schism, and the Beginnings of Black Priesthood Denial. And I think this is an extremely important essay because it argues the importance of polygamy as a factor in Brigham Young making the decision that blacks would no longer be allowed to hold the priesthood in the church. And what the catalyst of this incident was Brigham Young's confrontation with an African American associated, affiliated with the church by the name of William McCary. In the audience today, we have Patrick Polk. Go ahead, raise your hand. He's the world expert on William McCary, and we'll get to that portion. He probably should have been co-author with Connell on that essay, but he generously let Connell have the full honor of doing the essay, because it goes into somewhat broader areas, goes into some other African American and incidents that involved Brigham Young's confrontation, sometimes nasty confrontation with the issue and the problem of the place of African Americans within the church following Joseph Smith's death, and this as the catalyst leading to Brigham Young said we don't because we're practicing polygamy, what would it look like if we allowed blacks to hold the priesthood and they decide to go out and practice polygamy? That would reinforce the worst stereotypes concerning the images of the image of polygamy. But anyway, that it's an important essay. And then the following four essays deal with the following three essays deal with various schismatic groups. The three I mentioned: James J. Strang. Because James J. Strang, how many have heard of the Strangites? You know, they on Beaver Island, and they vigorously practiced polygamy, and his whole career almost paralleled. It was almost like an echo of Joseph Smith's earlier career, because ultimately his practice of polygamy and the controversy it created within the community ultimately led to his assassination, and the breakup of his community. And then the other schismatic leader, the second schismatic leader, Alphaeus Cutler, and he was a leader of another group. He very important leader in the early church. You don't hear much about him because he went off in a different direction. But he was very close to Brigham Young or to Joseph Smith. I'm sorry, to Joseph Smith in Nauvoo government, in the church, and he was involved in all of these secret organizations, the Council of 50. He was very, very intimate associate of Joseph Smith, and broke with the church with Brigham Young when Brigham Young actually initially supported Brigham Young and then broke with Brigham Young and went off in his own direction. So remained in the Midwest along with Strang, and then the other two people actually rejected polygamy. Now Cutler initially embraced it and then rejected it. Sort of almost a pattern with the Utah LDS Church, you know, they embrace it and then ultimately rejected it, and a similar thing happened, almost anticipating what was going to happen in the Utah Church, happened with the Cutlerites, and then the last two people, Sidney Rigdon, whom you've probably all heard of, who were LDS, and kind of a lieutenant of his by the name of Stephen Post. They were two individuals who completely rejected from the very beginnings polygamy. In fact, he initially broke with Joseph Smith and rejected it during Joseph Smith's lifetime, and was somewhat alienated even before Joseph Smith's death over the issue of polygamy. Now, and then there are three essays that will explore the way that the reorganized church reacted to polygamy, which is an interesting story in of itself. Don Bradley is doing a fascinating essay dealing with kind of what we call family feud in the 19th century. It involved the family feud between Joseph Smith III and his cousin Joseph F. Smith, family conflict that shaped the record of earliest Mormon polygamy. And then a second essay authored by myself deals with RLDS church reaction to Doctrine and Covenants 132. So we got three essays that, you know, touch in some way on 132. And I found that the story of, I didn't think there was going to be much there when I started to do research on the RLDS and their reaction to 132. I said, wow, this is morphed into kind of a separate, distinct essay in of itself, because I didn't realize there was so much and such vigorous reaction specifically to 132. And over the course of the history of the RLDS, now known as the Community of Christ. And the other essay in this section on the RLDS Church, the third essay on the RLDS, is written by retired, I guess you'd call him historian emeritus for the RLDS Church, a guy by the name of Richard P. Howard. And he's dealing with a very little known aspect of the RLDS, almost the irony, because the thing about Mormon history I found is just so full of ironies and contradictions, and what the supreme irony is that he's dealing with an incident in which the RLDS Church sent missionaries into India, and they confronted some Indian polygamists in India who wanted to become RLDS. And so, you know, they wanted to baptize them, but gosh, you know, we have this abhorrence, this historical abhorrence to polygamy. How are we going to handle this? And ultimately, they came down on the side of these people want to join, they want to become part of our Community of Christ, or at the time it was the RLDS. And eventually, they came up with a revelation allowing for the baptism and admission of these Indians, polygamous Indians, into the RLDS Church. And ironically, they have adopted a much more tolerant attitude toward Indians or toward polygamists in third world parts, third world countries, than what have the LDS Church. I mean, that's a supreme irony. So anyway, that's Richard Howard's written a really fascinating essay dealing with that topic. And the last essay is by a young scholar, another young scholar, who is a professor at BYU, Idaho. Her name is Andrea Radke Moss, and she's doing it on Mormon polygamous promotion of women's rights during the late 19th century. It's not like a contradiction of terms that Mormon women would be promoting women's rights, but you know, we won't get into the nuances of that, but she's dealing with that topic. Now we come to the last section of the volume, and that deals with the perpetuation of polygamy amongst Mormon fundamentalists. That's the last section of the book. And another young scholar, who's a fellow graduate student of Don's, a guy by the name of Christopher Blythe, is doing an essay on the precursors. Again, it's an essay that's promised to me, and I tell him that to get on the stick and get that essay to me. No. It's entitled The Precursors of Mormon Fundamentalism During the Late 19th and Early 20th Century. And again, that's a fascinating story. It's been often overlooked. It hasn't been documented that much, but it's a fascinating story that before the formal organization of Mormon fundamentalism into a cohesive movement, which later became movements, there was this almost like a subculture that was still a part of the larger LDS Church that, you know, practiced and promoted polygamy, and Christopher Blythe deals like with that in his essay. And the next essay is again another fascinating perspective on polygamy by a young fellow by the name of Joseph Lyman Jessup, who actually grew up in a polygamist community in Hamilton, Montana, a place called Pinedale. And he's actually a descendant of his grandfather on his maternal grandfather was Owen Allred, and then he was related to the Jessups, two very prominent families within Mormon fundamentalism. And he relates his life almost nostalgically about what it was like growing up as a polygamist in a polygamist community. He ultimately became joined the Utah Latter-day Saint Church. It's interesting to note, it's a personal note here too. He lives up in Hamilton now. He still has very good relations with his father is a leader. His mother is a leader of that polygamous community, and he still has very good relations with his family and everything else. He's now a member of the Hamilton ward up there, which my stepmother belongs to. And the bishop of that ward, he's actually written an essay for this volume, which I'll get to momentarily. But the next two essays that I want to mention are two that are done by Kenneth Driggs, who is one of the foremost experts on 20th century Mormon fundamentalism. And in one essay, he's dealing with Joseph White Musser, who was one of the major leaders within of Mormon fundamentalism and the founder of what became the major publication voice of the fundamentalist community, Truth Magazine. That's what the first essay deals with. A second essay that he's doing for the volume deals with a schism within Mormon fundamentalism, the FLDS Church, and the emergence of Centennial Park or the Second Warders. And Driggs is probably, as I say, he's one of the foremost experts because he's been working for years in this area, and he has a lot of contacts, a lot of friends within the Mormon fundamentalist community, and he's acted as a legal advisor. He's trained as a lawyer, and in a number of the cases that, you know, when they've had problems and everything else, Driggs has given him pro bono advice, and so a kind of interesting guy. And then the next essay is by Eric Paul Rogers. As I mentioned earlier, Eric Paul Rogers happens to be the bishop of the ward that my stepmother belongs to, and a good friend of Joe Jessup. They kind of work together on their two essays. And what Eric Paul Rogers is doing an essay, Ruin C. Allred, who of course was a very, very important leader, and the emergence of the Apostolic United Brethren and the AUB enclave in Montana. And then I've got an essay in there dealing with race, ethnicity, and the status of African Americans within Mormon fundamentalism, which is an interesting story in of itself because what happened when the LDS Church granted the priesthood to blacks with the 78 Revelation, there was a great deal of noise that came from the fundamentalist community, saying that this is one more example of how the mainline LDS Church has abandoned the true faith. You know, they first abandoned plural marriage, they abandoned the United Order, and now they're letting those inferior blacks have the priesthood. And so it sort of tells that story, but it also deals with the antecedents, how that built up even before that time. And then the last essay in this section is one written by Craig Foster, which deals with a media stereotyping of Mormon polygamy, like two crazy aunts in the attic, from Joseph Smith to Warren Jeffs. And then the final essay is a bibliographical essay co-authored by Todd Compton here and Pat Scott. Pat Scott, who is actually, she is the co-executive director of the Mormon History Association, and she's also done a lot of extensive writing in the field of Mormon women's studies. And so she and Todd have put together a wonderful bibliographical essay that, you know, really is a capstone for the whole volume. Now I'm going to allow, I guess we'll go in the, who wants to go first? Any preference about who goes before whom or anything else?
Take your choice.
Okay. Well, I'll let the young scholar go first, since then you know, because he's then he can won't be anxiously waiting. We'll let Don Bradley go first.
Just like earlier, my earlier presentation today, I don't have a printed text or golden plates. I just have my Urim and Thummim. The essays that I'm going to be doing for that I am doing for this volume, and will shortly be getting to Newell, are first, as he said, one that deals with polygamy before Nauvoo and looks at two test cases. Two controversial cases, one being Fanny Alger, who reportedly had a polygamous relationship with Joseph Smith in Portland in the mid-1830s, and then Lucinda Harris, who was at the time married to someone else, George W. Harris, and reportedly had a relationship with Joseph Smith in Missouri in about 1838, but the timing on that one is controversial. Then the other essay, which Newell mentioned, deals with this conflict between two namesakes of Joseph Smith, his son Joseph III and his nephew Joseph F. Smith, who became the president of their respective Mormon church, and really dueled over their shared legacy, each one insisting that, well, one insisting that Joseph Smith had practiced and founded polygamy, and the other insisting that he had not. And that essay, that one is full of irony, because part of what I'll be arguing is that we have, in fact, such a rich record of Joseph Smith's practice of polygamy in great measure because his son, Joseph III, denied and vigorously campaigned to clear his father's name of polygamy. He came out here to Utah on missions, he published all sorts of things, and this just made the Utah Mormons, and particularly his cousin Joseph F. Smith, go through great pains to document his polygamy, to get affidavits from the various plural wives, the other people Joseph Smith had taught polygamy to, the people who performed the ceremonies. And so, ironically, we've got Joseph Smith III to thank for that rich record. I'm going to focus today on Fanny Alger, since I always shy away from controversy. Fanny Alger was a teenage girl living in the Smith home in Kirtland, as I said, in the mid-1830s. And her stay with the Smiths reportedly went quite smoothly until one night Emma discovered her with Joseph in a compromising situation on a hayloft in the barn, at which point she was promptly evicted from her former home. She was reportedly, according to one report at least, she was pregnant at this point. She headed west toward Missouri with family, but ended up stopping in Indiana and staying there. She married a non-Mormon, Solomon Custer, had a large family, and lived out her long life there. There are three main issues that I'm addressing, issues or questions regarding this relationship. First is the factuality of the relationship. Did it happen? Second, the timing of the relationship. When did it begin and when did it end? And third, the nature of the relationship. Was it a marriage? This is the most controversial point. People argue over whether this was actually an early polygamous marriage or whether it was an affair. The claims that it was actually an adulterous affair go back very early, but there are also claims from Fanny Alger's family and others that, in fact, it was a plural marriage. These days, seems like there are very few scholars who who deny the factuality of this, who deny that there was a relationship between the two. I can only, in fact, think of one scholar who might know who denies that.
Who is that?
It's, I can almost think of his name. He does a lot of work on the Brigham Young families with the Joseph Smith papers.
Somebody that's employed by the church, one of the...
Yeah.
Staker?
No, it's not Staker.
No.
It might come to me.
Mm. Is it Jeff...
Jeff Johnson, yeah.
Jeff Johnson denies there was a relationship.
Yeah, on the timing of their relationship, there are a couple basic issues. Todd here has written a good deal about Fanny Alger, and he has argued that a particular source, the Mosiah Hancock Journal, Mosiah Hancock account is extremely valuable in understanding what happened between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger and when it happened. She was, Mosiah was her first cousin, is that right? Yeah. So perhaps in a position to know what occurred. Then his account is appended to his father's autobiography. His father, Levi Hancock, wrote about his life, didn't say anything really about the Fanny Alger relationship. But then his son, after his death, his son Mosiah came and added memories that he had regarding his father's life. And in his account, let me actually pull that up here. He says that in 1832, Joseph Smith had taught polygamy to Levi Hancock, told him that it would be practiced. And then he has the main part of his story here. He says that at this time, so this would be around early 1833, Clarissa Reed, who became Mosiah Hancock's mother, was working at the Prophet's. She told the Prophet she loved Brother Levi Hancock. I'm wondering if I skipped something. Sorry, in the story, he says that it was understood that because Clarissa Reed was living in the Smith home, that she would probably marry Joseph Smith as a plural wife. But then there was essentially a bargain that was struck between Levi Hancock, who was in love with her, and Joseph Smith, that Levi Hancock could marry Clarissa Reed if he would help Joseph to win the hand of his niece Fanny Alger. And that's just in his account, that's basically the way that it goes down. It's a kind of a really homey style that he puts it in. She says, he has one of the family members saying, "Father goes to his sister and said, 'Clarissa, Brother Joseph, the prophet of the Most High God, loves Fanny and wishes her for a wife. What say you?' Said she, 'Go and talk to Fanny. It will be all right with me.' Father goes to Fanny and said, 'Fanny, Brother Joseph, the prophet loves you and wishes you for a wife. Will you be his wife?' 'I will, Levi,' said she. Father takes Fanny to Joseph and said, 'Brother Joseph, I've been successful in my mission.' Father gave her to Joseph, repeating the ceremony as Joseph repeated it to him." So in this account, Levi Hancock actually performs the marriage, and this would presumably be the first plural marriage that Joseph Smith entered. In another clue regarding the timing of this relationship is the 1835 article on marriage. This is published in the Doctrine and Covenants, and it indicates that there had been some problem within the church dealing with polygamy that had caused trouble. It says, "Inasmuch as this Church of Christ has been reproached with the crime of fornication and polygamy, we declare that we believe that one man should have one wife and one woman but one husband." some of the evidence on the, and I'm going to go back and analyze these things in more detail, the some of the evidence on the nature of the relationship would include Oliver Cowdery, a letter that he wrote in 1838, where he referred to, quote, a dirty, nasty, filthy affair of Joseph Smith's and Fanny Alger's. And then, on the other hand, as I mentioned, there are later claims by members of the Alger family and by early LDS historian Andrew Jensen and others that Fanny was one of Joseph Smith's first plural wives, if not the very first. So to help address these questions, one of the main sources that I've looked at is the Andrew Jensen papers. Andrew Jensen was, initially he was just kind of a freelance historian of Mormonism in the late 1800s. He had his own periodical that he published, and then he eventually came to work for the church and became the assistant church historian. He has these incredibly extensive research files at the LDS Church Library, Church History Library. And the way that I found them is by listening to the still small voice of Robin Jensen of the Joseph Smith papers, who alerted me to their existence, and very helpfully. Jensen published a list of the first known extensive list of Joseph Smith's wives, and the most authoritative. It has 27 wives listed. And in order to compile this list, he went around and he interviewed the surviving wives and others who knew about Joseph Smith's polygamy. And I was able to look at Jensen's list, his manuscript list, and his other research papers. And on this list, he lists, he puts Fanny Alger's name. He's got that on there. So he certainly considered her a wife. But as I examined the document more, it became clear to me that actually there were two people's handwriting on the document. On the top of the document were several names of Joseph Smith wives in dark pencil. Down at the bottom, there were a couple in dark pencil in the same handwriting. And in the middle, there was this very fine hand listed about 15 women. And based on other sources, I suspected that the person who had written that middle list was actually Eliza R. Snow. And so I compared the handwriting there to Eliza R. Snow's handwriting at the same time period and found a really strong match. So then I went and showed it to Jill Durr, who is working on a biography of Eliza and probably knows her handwriting at least as well as anyone. And she confirmed that, at least, you know, short of a professional handwriting analysis, she gave me the greatest certainty I think that we can have that that was her handwriting. So the reason Jensen put Fanny Alger on his list is that Eliza R. Snow had told him she was a wife of Joseph Smith. Another document in the collection showed why Eliza thought that, the basis on which she felt that she could say that Fanny Alger was a wife of Joseph Smith. Here are Jensen's notes on Fanny Alger specifically. Alger, Fanny, Joseph Smith's wife, one of the first wives Joseph married, Emma made such a fuss about in, and then that's crossed out, Sister E.R. Snow was well acquainted with her as she lived with the prophet at the time. She afterwards married in Indiana, where she became the mother of a large family. So what Eliza R. Snow told Andrew Jensen is that she, Eliza, actually lived in the Smith home at the time that there was this big fuss that Emma made about Fanny Alger in Kirtland. A lot of people are familiar with the fact that Eliza R. Snow lived with the Smiths in Nauvoo, where she became Joseph Smith's plural wife and had her own blow up with Emma. Fewer are familiar with the fact that Eliza actually lived with the Smiths twice during during the Kirtland period. In her autobiography, she says she lived with him once in the spring of 1836 and again at the beginning of 1837. So her testimony is, I think, quite valuable. She was able to see this relationship, or at least the blow-up that resulted from it, close up, and whatever she observed was at least consistent for her with Joseph having been married to Eliza rather than just having had an affair.
Her dates don't match, though, with Hancock's, do they?
The Hancock account doesn't say when the relationship was discovered. It gives a date for its beginning, which would be around March 1833. But I'll try to get back to that particular issue. It's a good question. So Eliza, by the time 1837 rolls around, Fanny Alger is living in Indiana and she's married to Solomon Custer. So the stay that Eliza is referring to, when this blow-up occurred, was not the second 1837 stay. It couldn't have been. So it had to be the spring 1836 stay. So we can date at least roughly when Emma discovered this relationship and the big fuss occurred. I am personally dubious about the Mosiah Hancock account. One of the reasons for that is I have trouble believing that Joseph and Fanny could have kept this relationship from Emma for 3 years, just right under her nose. I would also be surprised if Levi Hancock would leave out this vital information, but then, you know, then it would fall to his son to go and insert it. The account, if it's read fully, it seems to me also to assume an established polygamous culture. Polygamy in the account is treated as a matter of course. It's like, well, of course it was expected that because Fanny lived with the Smiths, she would marry Joseph. Early 1830s, that's the last thing any woman in Kirtland would have expected. But it might certainly would have made sense to Mosiah Hancock much later in the Utah period. Another factor on the timing that I mentioned is the article on marriage. The article on marriage, because it came out in 35 and it refers to a polygamous relationship that had brought reproach on the church, it's been assumed that the article was referring to the relationship between Joseph and Fanny. If that relationship has still not been outed but in 1836, then I don't think the article on marriage would be a response to that relationship. I believe then that there was another relationship, whether it was one Joseph Smith was involved in or someone else, there's another relationship that this statement responded to. But I do think that the article on marriage might be relevant to understanding the Fanny Alger case, because it not only refers to polygamy, but it says something else that's overlooked. It says, according to the custom of all civilized nations, marriage is regulated by laws and ceremonies. Therefore, we believe that all marriages in this Church of the Latter-day Saints should be solemnized in a public meeting or feast prepared for that purpose. While it's hard to say, this looks like it could be a response to rumors about secret marriages. It's saying, in connection with what it's saying about there having been incidents of polygamy, it's saying also, you know, we want everyone to know that we believe marriage should be performed in a public ceremony. So I think it's likely that by 1835 there were secret and private marriage ceremonies. On the nature of the relationship, whether it was a marriage or an affair, a few points that I would look at would be, for one, in Oliver Cowdery's letter, where he referred to this relationship as a dirty, nasty, filthy affair, I've checked for this. I've looked up this word affair to try and find out what it meant in the context of the 1830s. Did it have the same connotations that it does now of an illicit love relationship. And I still need to search that out more, but in what I've looked at so far, I'm not finding that connotation. I believe that in this case, while Albert Cowdery clearly disapproves of what happened, whether it was polygamy or anything else, he thinks that it was vile. His use of the term affair, I believe, is equivalent to something like incident. He's talking about it as a there was this dirty, nasty, filthy thing that happened between them. I have already mentioned Eliza R. Snow's testimony, where she had been around at this time, and yet she seemed pretty certain that this relationship had been a marriage. And if she hadn't been reasonably certain about that, then it's curious that she would provide Fanny Alger's name for Andrew Jensen to publish to the world as the name of a wife of Joseph Smith. If she thought maybe this was just a mistress, it wouldn't be safe to publish her name to the world. So she at least seems to have been convinced. Also, if as it seems, the relationship wasn't discovered until 1836, this would tend to favor a marriage, that the relationship was a marriage, or at least that it could have been a marriage. Because while Joseph Smith begins performing marriages that we know of in 1835, several months before this relationship would have come out, and if the relationship was discovered around the spring of 1836, then by that time also there would have already occurred the visitations or visions connected with the Kirtland Temple dedication, like the Joseph and Oliver's experience of Elijah, which at least later is connected with the authority to perform marriages. So this late date for the discovery of the relationship suggests that the relationship could have been contracted very late. It could have been 35 or 36 that it started, and there could have been a ceremony. On the other hand, it's very difficult to identify a likely officiator during this time period. Obviously, the Mosiah Hancock source would suggest that it happened earlier and Levi Hancock was the one who performed it, but as I've looked, I have trouble seeing anyone I think was really a likely officiator. So my basic conclusions would be that Joseph Smith did in fact have a sexual relationship with Fanny Alger while she lived in his home. That this relationship was probably understood by and agreed by its participants to be a marriage. That the marriage may have been or was likely contracted by a formal ceremony, but that it's difficult to identify a likely officiator. And that the relationship was discovered in 1836 by Emma Smith, who, quote unquote, made such a fuss about it and ejected Fanny from the home. And
it's kind of strange to sit here and hear someone else talking about plural marriages and Fanny Alger. No, it's far from the one who started it. So now I'll take 15 minutes and respond to his. Okay. Newell, he might have forgotten this, but he asked me to read from this, the bibliographical article, rather than the Marriage Age article.
Yeah.
I'll summarize the Marriage Age article for you after I look at this a little bit. But so, if you're bored by someone reading lists of titles, long paragraphs of lists of titles, blame him for it. No, actually, I will, even though there are paragraphs that are long lists of titles, I'll try to pick out some of the, some parts that are not so much the long lists. We structured this historically. In other words, we didn't look at the earliest writing on polygamy and then, you know, end up with things that were published last year. Instead, we looked at the history of polygamy. And so this is kind of a, my essay is kind of a history of polygamy. So I'm going to read those. Each section has a little introductory paragraph, so I'm going to read those right now, and that'll give you right here a little introduction to the history of polygamy. Okay, polygamy in other cultures. Polygamy is a widespread practice in world culture and world history. Irwin Altman and Joseph Gannett, who published a really fine book called Polygamous Families in Contemporary Society, that we'll mention a little later on, estimate that 78% of world cultures practice polygamy, including Islam, much of Africa, formerly American Indians. Less than 1% practice polyandry, and 21% are monogamous. So we sometimes forget, you know, the impact of polygamy in world culture and history. Next section, polygamy in the Old Testament and Islam. Mormonism, like many Protestant churches, began as a restorationist Christian primitivist movement, which is to say that it was dedicated to restoring sacred institutions in the Bible. Joseph Smith Jr., Joseph Smith's founding, Mormonism's founding prophet, felt especially close to the Old Testament. So he believed his mission was to restore Old as well as New Testament traditions, such as the authority of prophets, temple rituals, and the ancient Semitic custom of plural marriage. He took Abraham as his model when he restored the practice of polygamy. In some ways, Joseph and other Mormons modeled their practice and ideology of polygamy on Old Testament practice and ideology. In other ways, they did not. For example, Leviticus specifically forbids marrying a woman and her mother, or a woman and her sister. But Mormons simply ignored these prescriptions. Polygamy in Protestantism. We tend to think of Mormon polygamy as so distinctive that it rises seemingly out of nowhere during Joseph Smith's lifetime. But actually, given polygamy's biblical roots, other restorationist primitivist groups recognized that polygamy was practiced by many prophets and kings in the Old Testament and were interested in the phenomenon, and indeed sometimes even practiced polygamy. The standard work on the subject is John Cairncross, After Polygamy Was Made a Sin, The Social History of Christian Polygamy. Luther allowed polygamy in certain cases, but Calvin denounced it when some Anabaptists and Lutherans had started to practice it. Okay, list of titles here. Mm-hmm. The Protestant poet John Milton also advocated polygamy. I have a little section on general histories of Mormon polygamy. B. Carmen Hardy's Magisterial, Doing the Works of Abraham, Mormon Polygamy, Its Origin, Practice, and Thought, published in 2007, combines Hardy's characteristic scholarly erudition, stylistic elegance, and breadth of insight as he surveys the panorama of polygamy's history among the Latter-day Saints. He looks at his subject with enormous sympathy, quoting generously from many documents that tell the story of plural marriage, providing commentary and context as he does so. If one had to recommend only one book on Mormon polygamy to a novice, or assign one book on polygamy to a class, this would be the book. Okay, my next section is Joseph Smith and polygamy. According to Messiah Hancock, whose father Levi reportedly performed a plural marriage for the Mormon prophet, the first of these unions occurred in Ohio in 1833 when Joseph married 16-year-old Fanny Alger. Smith's next marriage may have occurred in 1838 in Missouri. Okay, just out of curiosity, do you accept that as a marriage in that date?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, and there's more support for that in the Andrew Jensen paper.
Yeah, there is. There's definitely support.
But the great majority of his 33 well-documented marriages, give or take a few because formal records were not always kept, occurred in 1841-44 in Nauvoo, Illinois. There he combined restorationist biblical polygamy with the idea that one could gain a higher status in the next life based on the quantity of wives and offspring one possessed in this life. This gave the religious rationale for large plural families in later Mormonism. Thus, polygamy, called celestial, meaning heavenly, or patriarchal marriage, after the polygamous patriarchs of the Old Testament, such as Abraham and Jacob, was accepted as necessary for exaltation, the highest salvation in the Mormon heaven. Present-day Mormons generally accept that eternal monogamous marriage is sufficient for exaltation, but also still anticipate that there will be polygamy in heaven. Joseph Smith practiced practical polyandry as well by marrying 11 women who were already civilly married to other men. However, these marriages were not ideologically polyandrous, as only the marriage to Smith was considered to be celestial and eternal. Okay, long list of books here that I'm mercifully passing over. Utah polygamy. During Joseph Smith's lifetime, polygamy in Nauvoo and elsewhere was kept secret because it was also illegal. However, after Smith's death, during the Mormon exodus to Utah and in frontier Utah, the era of open plural marriage began. Brigham Young had Orson Pratt publicly announce Mormon polygamy and defend it in August 1852. In Utah, Mormons experienced the nuts and bolts of daily life in large plural families. The results were various. One finds many inspiring stories of women and men who struggled against great challenges to make the ancient Semitic custom work in modern America. On the other hand, there are stories of polygamous husbands giving greater attention and financial assistance to favored wives, while less favored wives had a difficult time surviving financially and emotionally. Even in the best of plural marriages, a woman had only limited access to her husband's time, resources, and emotional attention. To compensate, plural wives often developed especially close relationships with their children to make up for often distant husbands. Despite such problems, polygamy was regarded almost as the most central, highest revelation to Joseph Smith and a necessary prerequisite for complete salvation. It was widely accepted as a divinely inspired concept by church members, male and female. However, plural marriage was more widely practiced among the elite than among the church's rank and file, a good number of the latter remaining monogamous, though a number of them also were polygamous. One persistent myth about Mormon polygamy has been that only about 2 or 3% of the church membership ever practiced polygamy. Actually, something like 20 or 30% of Latter-day Saints engaged in the practice, depending on the statistical strategy one employs. Lowell Ben Benyon, in his article, The Incidence of Mormon Polygamy in 1880, Dixie versus Davis Stake, 1984, published in 1984, concludes that at least one-fifth of Mormons lived in plural households in 1880. In a number of communities in Dixie, as many as 40 or 50% of the inhabitants were polygamists. Okay. I found lots of interesting articles that I passed up somehow on very odd little topics in Mormon history, such as polygamous architecture. how you built buildings for your plural wives. And there's a group of articles, even one book about that. Okay, the legal battle over polygamy. Some of the prominent visitors to Pioneer Utah, such as Richard Burton and Mark Twain, looked at polygamy with respectful curiosity or irreverent amusement. However, there were reformers in the eastern states who were shocked by its affront to Protestant and Victorian custom. They generally overlooked the fact that biblical prophets and some early Protestants had practiced polygamy. In 1854, the first Republican Party platform inveighed against the twin relics of, quote, twin relics of barbarism, unquote, slavery and polygamy. And after Congress passed the Merrill Anti-Bigamy Act of 1862, Republican Abraham Lincoln signed it into law. Believing that the revelations of God took precedence over laws of men, Mormons simply ignored it. Yet the political pressure against polygamy increased throughout the century. Utah was still a territory and desperately seeking statehood so it could legalize polygamy. As it happened, polygamy was one of the central reasons Utah could not obtain statehood. Okay. The moving on. Eventually, Mormons had to give up polygamy. The transition to monogamy was not easy for Latter-day Saints because polygamy had played such a central role in Mormon doctrine and culture for so long, which is quite a contrast to the what Newell referred to, how we're editing polygamy out of our historical record in odd ways, taking Brigham Young's wives out of the priesthood men. Polygamy was regarded as theologically necessary for complete salvation. Many church leaders, therefore, even after polygamy was given up by the manifesto, continued a sub rosa promotion of plural marriage after publicly giving up the practice, inaugurating what has been called the post-manifesto era of Mormon polygamy. The Wilford Woodruff First Presidency, including George Q. Cannon and Joseph F. Smith, sent many Mormons to church colonies in Mexico to be married plurally. Among the apostles, the members of the second highest quorum of the church, those who married plurally after the manifesto included apostles John W. Taylor, Brigham Young Jr., Mariner W. Merrill, Abraham Owen Woodruff, Matthias F. Kelly, Rutger Clausen, Abraham Hoagland Cannon, and George Teasdale. And we've kind of edited this out of our accepted history also, that and often we think of post-manifesto polygamy as just a two-couple rogue apostles, but First Presidency was sanctioning post-manifesto polygamous marriages, and a lot of apostles were engaged in it. Some prominent historians of the era, such as D. Michael Quinn and B. Carmen Hardy, accept that Wilford Woodruff took a post-manifesto plural wife, while Woodruff's biographer, Thomas Alexander, disagrees. Many of these marriages were solemnized in Mexico by Anthony Ivins, who later became a member of the First Presidency. Other post-manifesto marriages were solemnized in Canada, shipboard on the Pacific Ocean, and in Utah and neighboring states. When word of these secret marriages leaked out, as was inevitable, anti-polygamy activists were infuriated. Apostle Reed Smoot, himself a monogamist, was elected a U.S. Senator in 1904, but the Senate refused to fully accept him until it had examined the sincerity of LDS allegiance to the manifesto that Wilford Woodruff had released. The hearings were a great embarrassment to the LDS Church. As a result, Joseph F. Smith released a second manifesto in 1904, reiterating that the Church had abandoned polygamy. Two apostles who had been prominent in post-manifesto plural marriages, John Taylor and Matthias Kelly, were released from the Quorum of the Twelve and subsequently dismissed from the church, excommunicated in one case and disfellowshipped in the other. Since 1904, LDS members who practiced polygamy have usually been excommunicated, and 20th century Mormons have become monogamous to a remarkable degree as they have sought to enter the mainstream of Mormon American culture. Okay, and I'll mention two major works on this subject. D. Michael Quinn's 1985 article, LDS Church Authority and New Plural Marriages, 1890 to 1904. It was a really great article. And then B. Carmen Hardy's Solemn Comment, Mormon Polygamous Passage, 1992, is another really fine book on this subject. Fundamentalist polygamy. Yank me down here when it's time.
Okay.
Partially as a result of the conflicting messages of church leaders during the post-manifesto period, many Mormons felt the need to continue the principle, even though they knew they would be excommunicated from the church as a result. Many of them traced their authority lineage through what they describe as a secret transfer of authority effected by John Taylor in 1886. Many present-day polygamists view Mormon church presidents after Taylor as traitors to the true restored religion. Presently, there are an estimated 30,000 to 60,000 polygamous fundamentalists living in Utah and surrounding states. The two leading groups are the United Apostolic Brethren, located in a suburb of Salt Lake City, and residents of the twin border towns of Colorado City and Hilldale, originally called Short Creek, straddling the Utah-Arizona border, and known as the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In one of the ironies of history, the LDS Church coordinated with political leaders for a police raid on Short Creek polygamists in 1953, during which mothers were separated from some 263 children and fathers sent to jail. Okay. Last section, ideological persistence in mainstream Mormonism. For many mainstream Mormons, practical polygamy has faded safely away into the pages of history. Nevertheless, the impact of polygamy lingers on, first because there are so many passages in church literature in praise of polygamy, statements from Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, and Joseph F. Smith, among others, stating that polygamy is necessary for the highest salvation. Many present-day Mormons expect to be polygamists in the next life, even though they may be personally uncomfortable with the concept and are happy to be only monogamists in this life. Influential apostle Bruce R. McConkie, in his book Mormon Doctrine, published in 1958, looked in his section called Plural Marriage, looked forward to the time when the holy practice of polygamy would be practiced once again. Furthermore, if a faithful man's wife dies and the man remarries in the temple, he is sealed to both women for eternity. Many contemporary Mormon widowers thus regard themselves as eternal polygamists. Eugene England, in his essay, Fidelity, Polygamy, and Marriage, published in 1987, argues that polygamy is not the celestial order of marriage. The fact that he has to argue this shows that many Mormons still believe, with 19th century Mormons, that polygamy will be present in the celestial kingdom, the highest Mormon heaven. However, few contemporary Mormons accept that polygamy is necessary for exaltation, as many 19th century church leaders taught. So, if I were to recommend one book from each period, what would I recommend? Well, in a couple places I would have to waffle between two, but let me just give you what I would recommend. In Polygamy and Protestantism, I mentioned Karen Cross's After Polygamy Was Made a Sin. Okay, for overall polygamy, as I mentioned, Carmen Hardy's Doing the Works of Abraham is where I recommend that you start, or if you're going to read one book, read that one. Joseph Smith and Polygamy, I'd say choose between my In Sacred Loneliness and George D. Smith's Nauvoo Polygamy. And mine emphasizes women, Joseph Smith's Plural Wives, and Smith's emphasizes Joseph Smith more than I do. Okay, for Utah polygamy, I would recommend Lawrence Foster's Religion and Sexuality, The Shakers, the Mormons, and the Oneida Community, published in 1981. And it's a fascinating book because it looks at more than just Mormonism, compares it with these other fascinating books, but it's a really wonderful interpretation of polygamy itself. And I would choose between that and Catherine Dane's More Wives Than One, Transformation of the Mormon Marriage System, 1840 to 1910, published in 2001, which it's kind of a statistical study. It looks at Mormon polygamy in Manti. There's a lot you can disagree with in this book, but it's a really a fine book.
Who published it?
That was published by Illinois Press.
University of Illinois Press. Yeah.
In The Legal Battle Over Polygamy, Sarah Berenger Gordon's The Mormon Question, Polygamy and Constitutional Conflict in 19th Century America, 2002. Post-Manifesto Polygamy, I mentioned the long article by Quinn and Hardy's Solemn Covenant. Fundamentalist polygamy, for what polygamous life is like, Altman and Gannett's Polygamous Families in Contemporary Society, published in 1996, really, really wonderful. Okay, for the history of polygamy, of fundamentalist polygamy, Brian C. Hale's Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalists, The Generations After the Manifesto, published in 2006. And Don has been working with Brian in a new book Brian Hales is writing on Joseph Smith's polygamy. And so that will be great when that comes out. Okay, so that'll give you a start for if you want to read about polygamy.
These books you've just read off, they're going to be listed in here somewhere?
Yeah, and they'll be in the bibliographical essay. Yeah. I mean, he's doing a whole, he's just excerpted portions of his... he's just summed up the highlights of what's an extensive, comprehensive bibliographical essay. You got the short version. And before I open up the questions, I just want to very quickly mention just a couple of things. These two presentations give you an idea, a taste, and a flavor of what's going into the volume. And I must confess, on a personal level, my own knowledge and appreciation, I came into this, I'm not an expert on polygamy, and I guess it's somewhat presumptuous that I would assume the role of editor, but there's a number of reasons why I jumped into this, which I won't go into here, but I just should say that in doing this project, my own knowledge and appreciation of this topic has been greatly expanded, and I've learned to appreciate just the complexity and the depth and everything of and the contradictions and all of this in this topic and that there's so much that I don't know and in this I'm kind of wryly reminded of a interesting exchange that took place between Brigham Young and Tom Thumb. I don't know if you heard of Tom Thumb. He was the famous circus midget. Upon meeting Young for the first time, Tom Thumb pointedly asked the Mormon leader, "I frankly cannot comprehend this practice of plural marriage." Unruffled, Young quickly replied, "When I was your size, I didn't understand it either." Seriously, it's hoped that the essays in this volume will enlighten readers concerning the central role polygamy played in the entire course. And that's what I really want to emphasize with this volume, is the centrality of polygamy that, so much of it's being come lost, strayed and stolen, to paraphrase another historian. I thought, well, maybe I'm going to require all of my editors to maybe wear one of these, which will, we didn't go to Salt Lake to publicize our book. I don't know if you've seen this. It's a polygamy porter. Well, anyway. when one is not enough. Right, okay. Okay, we'll go open it. Well, on that little humorous aside, I guess we'll open it for questions. Yes.
So Don, when you were talking about the, I didn't get all the names, but was it Hancock who helped facilitate the marriage between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger?
Yeah, in his son's account, that was Levi Hancock.
When did he write that account? And when was the liaison between Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger? Was that 1933?
Well, that's part of what's in question, is when it occurred. And the Mosiah Hancock account is one piece of evidence for when it occurred. He places it in 1833.
When did he give that account?
If I'm not mistaken.
It's late.
Yeah, the Levi Hancock writes his life story in like 79 or something, and he passes away. And then his son writes, I believe it's in the 1890s, that his son adds more material that wasn't in his father's write-up.
So how seriously should we take the accuracy of that?
Well, that's a matter that's controversial. I mean, so Todd's published in the Journal of Mormon History on an article on Fanny Alger and then a chapter in his book, In Sacred Loneliness, about her. And he argues he offers reasons to take it seriously. He argues that it's legit. I would tend to be more critical. I am open to it, and I think there could be some
core there, but I think Mosiah Hancock is getting some things garbled myself, and I gave a couple.
Liz, is that you still your view, Todd?
Yeah, I accept Levi Hancock, but even in the article and the chapter, I looked at problems in Mosiah Hancock's account. You know, the fact that it's late, you know, some things are contradictory, but that's standard for people writing, you know, autobiographically and remembering, you know, it's standard for Mormons writing who are not trained historians, you know. But history is full of stuff like this, where someone says something and you say, do I believe him? And, it's totally justified if you say, no, I don't believe him. And you can be totally justified in saying, well, yes, I do believe him. Of course, what you do is you try to find evidence for both sides, you know. But it just because someone says something doesn't mean that it's, you have to accept it as true, you know. So we look at both sides, and I can see evidence for and against. I still tend to accept it.
I don't know who that is.
Would you just say that he distorted the date of that marriage, or is he fabricating this, or, I mean, to what degree would you say that that's distorted?
That's a good question. I'm not certain what. I do think that some of what he's saying is likely rooted in something. I'm dubious that what actually happened is anything like substantially like what he described. So I don't know if you can accept the account basically and reject the date, because in the account that he gives, there's like a trade, you know. Joseph says, well, you can marry her if you help me get her. And so that would tend to, if you accept that, then that would tend to stick it at 1833. I think it's, I think there may have been a third party officiator performing a ceremony, and it may have been the case that that was Levi Hancock, and maybe Mosiah Hancock and his memory, you know, he's got that detail right, but then he's mixing it up with other events that weren't related. I'm not really sure. It needs to be sussed out a lot more.
I was going to say, it's almost too bad that you don't have this in your modern polygamy thing. You talk about the raid on short people. What about the raid on Plano, Texas? I mean, you know, there we got fodder for a whole book there. Because there's so much documented stuff that you can go through there.
Or an HBO miniseries.
That'll be the next one, yeah.
Well, I think we can make light of it, but I think it was really terrible what the government did to those people, to separate those wives from their children, and then it all turned out that this whole thing was a hoax to begin.
Yeah, it was a replay of what happened in Short Creek in 1953 when all the children were taken away from the wives, essentially a replay with a bunch of Yahoo Texas Rangers, you know.
Yeah.
They are concerned about child abuse. Some of the wives are very, very young.
They do have convictions.
And you wonder whether they're old enough to give consent. And by law, some of them are not. And you may disagree with the law, but take it up in the Texas legislature. For that matter, I mean, the whole thing was illegal in Illinois. Illinois had been a state since 1818. There were laws against having more than one spouse. This whole thing was done, you know, as a sub, below the radar, so to speak. My question is, who's done the best work on the final extinction in the 1930s when J. Reuben Clark and Mark E. Peterson and others, they go after beloved relatives and state presidents?
Well, I'll tell you a good place to start is, he's not in the room, he went to another session, is a really a fascinating, evocative chapter in Michael Quinn's biography on J. Reuben Clark, elder statesman. He deals with a large part of a whole chapter on that whole issue. That would be one place to go. I mean, the definitive work is still to be done on that. I mean, and the other place to go, which is another kind of ancillary work, would be James A. Talmage articles of faith, because he deals with a whole incident that took place in Latter-day Revelation, as contained in the book Articles of Faith. You know, that's the name
only
of the,
in our edition.
Yeah, it's and in their edition, but it was originally published by the Church's Latter-day Revelation. It was published in 1930. And it was actually kind of an effort to try to streamline for the church membership the contents of the Doctrine and Covenants. And what they did is they said they were eliminating a lot of the earlier sections of the Doctrine and Covenants that dealt with kind of local issues and issues involving members at that time, trivial type of stuff, and just including the essential doctrinal things. But what else they excluded were references to polygamy, including the entire most of section 131, which touches on anticipates 132, and the entire section 132. And that incident, when that came out in 1930, that caused such a stink that they withdrew publication. It was the Talmage did the editorial work on it, but it appeared without an author on the cover. It had the appearance of being an official church book because there was no author's name. It just said Latter-day Revelation, and it caused such an uproar that they quickly withdrew it from sale. And the story of that is told in the, I guess you got copies of that on the table out there. Free plug for Tom.
Latter-day Revelations.
Latter-day Revelations, yeah.
But come on, talk to me afterwards.
But you could look at, you could look at Brian Hale's book also.
Yeah,
I'm sure that.
Hale's is kind of skewed though in certain ways. It's the best thing out there, I agree. But there's his treatment of the fundamentalists, I don't think, is as balanced as it could be. That's my opinion. But, mm-hmm. but it's still the best thing out there. If you're looking, I agree with you, if you're looking for one volume dealing with 20th century fundamentalism, the place to start would be Brian Hale's, Modern Polygamy? Yeah.
I'm going to pick on Don to see my roommate. Don't you think that it's possible that Liza R. Snow, when she's referring to Fanny being a marriage, that she's just going, oh, well, Joseph Smith hit my marriage, and so since there was this rumor that she was living with him and they were sleeping together, it must have been just like my situation. And mine was a marriage, so hers must have been a marriage, too.
Yeah, well, in her case, I don't... Based on what she's saying to Jensen, she doesn't get this through rumor. She says she was there living in the Smith home at the time, which would have put her much closer to the event than the gossip that was going around. I don't know how much they would have actually talked about this incident when it happened.
Didn't see it, why would we think that Liza R. Snow wouldn't see it?
No, I'm saying when the blow-up occurred, it would have been talked about in the home. When Fanny suddenly kicked out during the middle of the night, which is what happened, and Emma is furious.
Possibly pregnant, which would have been public.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any way that Eliza, living in the home, could not be hearing the talk about it.
Well, she could be hearing the talk about the affair, and that Joseph and Fanny were sleeping together. But she may have just assumed, since later, when Joseph was sleeping with her, and that was kept secret from Emma also. But in the same case, I got married to him, so Fanny must have gotten married to him too.
Yeah.
Must have been the same thing.
It's certainly possible. I'm not saying that this would be definitive evidence. What I'm saying is that it is evidence for something, and it seems to me that given that she was there and that she's sufficiently confident that Fanny was a wife, that she's putting her on a list that she knows is for publication, then it seems like that certainly weighs in on the side of this having been a marriage. It would be one factor among others to weigh.
I'm hearing men, okay. I got this attack once, right? I see three guys up there. Okay, and I don't hear anybody sticking up for Emma. I'm just saying, you know what? Joseph was cheating on me. It was an affair. They were all affairs.
Carrie Mills? No.
How do you account for this big time gap between Fanny Alger and the next plural wife? And then you get this real explosion of them. But if this is really a marriage, why is it taking so long to really make it as marriage?
That's a good question.
I don't think we know for sure how long it is till the next marriage. I mean, there's 1838, appears to be when he marries Lucinda Harris. That's about 2 years after the blow up over Fanny Alger.
When is Louise David? I thought that was the first.
That was 41.
That's Nauvoo.
Yeah, that's.
There is some controversy over Lucinda Harris, which is part of the reason why I'll be talking about her as well in this chapter. Some people date her relationship with Joseph Smith to Nauvoo, because that's when he does most of his polyandrous marrying, and her case was polyandrous. But I think that the Jensen papers have new evidence that 38 is the right date. There are several lines of evidence for it. So it looks like the Fanny Alger blow-ups in the middle of 36, early to mid-38, he marries Lucinda Harris. And the next one that's certainly well-known is in early 41. But I think a reason for a lag between Fanny Alger and Lucinda Harris is that the Fanny Alger relationship ends really, really badly.
Also, you know, Mormons were getting kicked out of Kirtland, went to Missouri, being kicked out of Missouri. It was not a peaceful situation until they got to Nauvoo. But a good question.
Yeah, I read the Catherine Plate's book on the Smoot hearings. Is that considered to be a pretty good source?
Yeah, that's a great book. Yeah.
The nice thing was, is I got that book